Call this meeting of the Senate Resources Committee to order. Let the record reflect that it is 3:30 p.m. on Monday, March 25th, 2019. Present are Vice Chair Coghill, Senator Giesel, Senator Reinbold, Senator Keel, Senator Kawasaki, Senator Bishop is excused, and myself, Chairman Birch. I don't see any legislators in the office or in the audience, and I would ask that you please silence your cell phones. We have two items on today's agenda. The governor's appointment of Jesse Chmielewski on the Alaska Oil and Gas Commission, and a project update by the Pebble Partnership. Regarding the AOGCC appointee, we'll begin with the governor's appointee. And just to refresh committee members and the public, AOGCC is a three-member commission that oversees oil and gas drilling, development, and production, reservoir depletion, and metering operations. They act on behalf of the state to prevent waste, protect correlative rights, improve ultimate recovery, and protect underground fresh water. Ms. Chmielewski was appointed to the Commission's Petroleum Engineer seat on March 7th of this year, and her term would expire in May 2025. Ms. Chmielewski, please take a seat, state your name for the record, and please tell us a little bit about your background, qualifications, and interest in the job of AOGCC Commissioner. Welcome.
Good afternoon, Chair Birch, Vice Chair Coghill, and members of the Senate Resources Committee. Thank you for making time for my confirmation hearing today. Can you hear me? Okay. My name is Jesse Chmielewski. I'll start by telling you why I applied for the job, and then I will describe my experience and qualifications. I want to be the Petroleum Engineering Commissioner for the AOGCC because it is a very important role that I think I can do very well. Using my skills and experience to protect the public interest in Alaska's oil and gas resources is something that I would be honored and proud to do. Alaska has been my home for nearly two decades, and this is where I plan to stay. Over the last several years, I have enjoyed working on projects cooperatively with the AOGCC, and I would be happy to join that smart and capable team. A little bit about me. I grew up in the Bay Area of California and then went to Rice University in Houston, Texas, where I received a Bachelor of Science in Chemical Engineering and a Bachelor of Arts in Environmental Engineering Sciences. But California and Texas just weren't big enough for me, so I moved to Alaska in 2000. My husband and my kids were born in Alaska, and I think it's a great place to raise a family. I am qualified for this position based on my experience. I am registered as a professional petroleum engineer in the state of Alaska, and I have 19 years of experience all in Alaska. During my career in industry, I spent 3 years as an engineer in the North Slope, and I understand oil field operations from the sand face to the sales meter. This includes seismic and geology, drilling and completions, well work, artificial lift, operations and facilities, metering, and well integrity issues. I have a deep and broad understanding of oil and gas developments in Alaska, having worked as an engineer on a variety of reservoirs and fluid types, light oil, viscous oil, and heavy oil. In addition, I have direct government regulatory experience from my position as the Senior Petroleum Engineer for the Bureau of Land Management Alaska State Office. In this role, I cover the regulatory oversight functions of both the AOGCC and the Division of Oil and Gas. Many times I was working on projects cooperatively with the state of Alaska. I have reviewed drilling permits and fiscal meter applications like the AOGCC, and I have worked on unit agreements and development obligations like the DOG. In this way, I have a holistic view of the entire process. I was the main point of contact within the BLM for decisions pertaining to ConocoPhillips' new developments in NPRA. In light of new discoveries and activity on the North Slope, to the east into ANWR, and to the west, NPRA, my experience will be a benefit to the state. Thank you.
Thank you very much for your presentation this afternoon, Ms. Chmielewski. See if there's any questions from committee members. Go ahead, Senator Reinbold.
First of all, I hope I'm reading your resume correctly. Do you have an environmental engineering degree, a petroleum engineering, and chemical engineering?
No, I have degrees in chemical engineering and environmental engineering sciences, and I'm a registered professional petroleum engineer.
Okay, excellent. And through the chair? Yeah, so that's just super impressive. You just have three really a broad spectrum there. So I was super impressed. And also, I'm impressed with your government and industry background. So I think, you know, with your BLM understanding, you know, perspective from government perspective and as well from the private sector, I really just wanted to make a comment that I'm incredibly impressed with your resume.
Am I supposed to answer through the chair? Thank you.
Other questions? Senator Kawasaki?
Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Thank you for being here and before us. And you have a very impressive resume, on reiterate what Senator Reinbold said. Just a couple questions. There's some redacted information at the top. It's probably your address, and then they typically do that. In the education, there's something that's been redacted. I don't know. I've just been just trying to puzzle what it could potentially be, and if you can't tell us or...
There's nothing in there that I think would be confidential. I don't know why it would be redacted. I'd be happy to show you.
Maybe the year?
Yeah. Maybe the year, right. Yeah. Maybe the year.
That's weird.
The year.
Okay. Okay. And then I guess just my second question through the chair, thank you, is that since you worked for the BLM State office, did you have confidential proprietary information that had to be held confidentially when you were talking about oil and gas leasing and NPRA?
Through the chair and Senator, absolutely yes. I saw and was available to me all of the confidential data in NPRA on federal onshore lands. It would be very similar to what the confidential data that the AOGCC currently holds.
Okay, and then the follow-up is then as a AOGCC commissioner, it wouldn't be a conflict to know maybe a higher level of information than you normally would have gotten, I guess. Is that correct then?
Through the chair, Senator, do you mean from my BLM experience?
Yes.
There's no conflict of interest. All of the information, same information is available to both agencies. I didn't see any of the state confidential information in that role, only the federal. Okay. But it's exactly the same information. I don't see any conflict.
Great. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you. Senator Giesel?
Thank you. So at BLM, you were the lead on the legacy well issue. We call them the travesty wells. Has someone taken over that position from you?
Through the chair, Senator. Yes, I did work on those legacy wells. I spent two winter seasons. I went on to the NPRA and oversight. That's part of how I developed this good relationship with the AOGCC. They have not replaced me over there, but they're continuing to do the work that they can, but they're almost out of money. So that will be the main thing to think about is how to help them secure funds to continue plugging wells.
Okay, thank you. Follow up? So you've been on the job for a couple weeks there at AOGCC. So what is your impression of how the commission is functioning? Do you feel there's enough staff, enough resources available to do the job well?
Yeah, through the chair, Senator. I'm very impressed with this commission. Through my work at the BLM and working on projects with the AOGCC, I have a high level of respect for the work that they do and the level of expertise there. My understanding is that they are, I think, staffed appropriately at the moment. You know, there are 9 inspectors, and that's one of the critical pieces we have is enough people out on the eyes on the ground, so to speak, to keep an eye on our operations. I'm sorry, was there another part to the question that I?
Just did you feel you have the resources you need? The agency?
Yes, thank you. So it's been 2 weeks, but I believe we have the resources we need at this moment. Thank you.
One more, Mr. Chairman. So your husband is employed by Oil Search. How will you manage that should an issue come forward from Oil Search?
Right. Through the chair, Senator, I think that's a really important question. This is an independent quasi-judicial commission. And it's super important that it be, completely unbiased in any way. So I'm fully open and transparent with all of my, you know, personal relationships. Of course, my husband working at Oil Search is a very important personal relationship. So I will be fully open and, if necessary, recuse myself from a decision if that seems appropriate. I would not like anything about me to reflect on the commission's good work. So I want to make sure that that's clear and distinct. I did have some BP stock, which I sold. So I don't have any, you know, interest in anything, any other company at this time.
One last question. So what does your husband do for Oil Search? What is his role there?
Right, through the chair. I'm trying to practice. He's the vice president of exploration, which is a super exciting and fun job for him. So they are looking to explore their current acreage and some newly acquired acreage on the North Slope.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Senator Keel.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Ms. Chmielowski, so thank you for the financial piece that you gave to the Senator Giesel. That was going to be one of my questions. In your resume, great engineering background, nothing shows about the adjudication, the quasi-judicial, the hearing part. Do you have a background in that part of an area of endeavor at all?
Through the chair, Senator, I think the commission is somewhat unique in that regard. It is, you know, as we said, independent, quasi-judicial, and unbiased. Through my role at the BLM, I did sort of enter that sphere of viewing operations and decisions from a government point of view. I think that keeping my actions, you know, clear and open and transparent, and of course consulting with the other commissioners will be a lot of value.
Yeah. Just to follow up. It's a good point that it's not, while it's quasi-judicial, it doesn't tend to have, you know, a lot of hearings. But are you receiving or are you seeking any particular training or help in learning those functions of the job? Is that something in your plans?
Absolutely. Through the chair, absolutely, yes. I want to do the best that I can in this job, and so I will seek mentorship or advice where appropriate on how to handle and do the meetings and the hearings and that sort of thing in the correct way.
Thank you.
Thank you. Seeing no further questions, at this point, we will go ahead and open public testimony here. And we have a two-minute time limit, and I would also encourage anybody listening to submit written comments to senateresources@akledge.gov. I don't really have anybody signed up to testify. Is there anybody in the room that wishes to testify? And I have no one online here. So with that, we'll close public testimony. At this point, are there any further questions? Senator?
Well, thank you, Mr. Chairman. I always get the fact sheet when we're talking about a board or commission. And so I have the fact sheet here. I have certainly used it in the past when folks have been nominated to this commission. And related to the question about adjudication experience, that's actually not part of the requirements or qualifications for this position. Because frankly, this is a regulatory position that deals with fact and the science behind the extraction of our resources and the maximum extraction, the maximum benefit for our citizens. So for the role that Ms. Chmielowski is applying, it says qualified petroleum engineer, has earned a degree from a university in the field of engineering and has at least 10 years of professional subsurface experience in the oil and gas industry in drilling, well operations, production process operations, reservoir engineering, or a combination thereof. So as you can see, Mr. Chairman, it's quite a technical role, and Ms. Chmielowski's resume certainly robustly represents those qualifications. Thank you.
Thank you. Any other questions or comments? Seeing none, we will, at this point, if there's without further questions, we will pass around a signing sheet, which for the record reads, quote, in accordance with AS 3505080, the Senate Resources Committee has reviewed the following and recommends the appointment be forwarded to a joint session for consideration. Jesse Chmielowski, Alaska Oil and Gas Conservation Commission. This does not reflect an intent by any of the members to vote for or against the confirmation of the individual during any further sessions. We'll take a brief at ease to sign the paperwork and get set up for the next presentation.
Thank you very much. I appreciate it.
back on record here. I just wanted to clarify on the signing document that it is a Alaska Statute 3905080 that relates to the process that we use for forwarding names for joint consideration. With that, I think we are set up here, and we have Tom Collier, John Shively, and James Hugh from the Pebble Partnership to give us an update on the Pebble Project. We requested this update in light of the recently released U.S. Army Corps of Engineers draft environmental impact statement, which details the potential impacts of developing a large copper and gold mine in the Bristol Bay region. That draft EIS is open for public comment until May 30th. Gentlemen, thank you for being here. Please put your names and titles on the record and proceed with your presentation.
I'm Tom Collier. I'm the CEO of Pebble Partnership.
John Shively. I'm chairman of the board of Pebble Mines.
James Hugh, vice president of permitting for Pebble Partnership.
So thank you, Mr. Chairman, Mr. Vice Chairman, members of the committee, for the opportunity to be here today and bring you up to speed on where we are in our pursuing a mine out in Bristol Bay for Pebble. A little bit about my background before I get started. I'm not a typical mining guy. My career has been in the areas of dealing with environmental issues and in permitting large controversial projects. And I've done that for most of my career and spent a good bit of time working during the Clinton administration as the chief of staff to the Department of Interior, where I worked directly with Bruce Babbitt and with Al Gore and with Bill Clinton on some of the nation's biggest and most difficult environmental challenges of the time. And one of the reasons I was chosen for this job is that that's the perspective and view I bring to natural resources development, is you should only do it responsibly. You should only do it where you can protect the environment. But when you can, you ought to take advantage of the natural resources opportunities that are there. And when I worked with Bruce and with Al and with the president, they had something that they taught me, which was how to come at these issues. And the first thing they all three agreed on was that it's a false dilemma to say that you have to choose between natural resources development and environmental protection, that they can second coexist. And the way you determine whether they can coexist and how they can coexist is by looking intensively and comprehensively at the available science. And the way you do that is through an environmental impact statement. And that's where we are today. We've finally gotten this project to the point where we have an independent assessment by the Corps of Engineers of the controversial issues that have been talked about for a dozen years in Alaska. And we're pretty proud of where we are, and we think we've got some very good results here. We're going to share them with you as we go through our project today, go through our presentation today. To begin with, just a minute about why we mine these days. And, of course, you know, everything in modern life probably has a trace back to mining of some type, but copper especially. For technology in America, you know, when people tell me they don't want to have copper mines built, I ask them if they'll hand me their cell phone. But it's not just technology. It's especially, as we look forward, green technology. And wind turbines and solar panels and electric vehicles all require an enormous amount of copper. And just in transportation, the amount of copper that goes into electric vehicles, and especially electric buses, is huge. There's kind of a dirty little secret that's becoming more and more public, and that is, as we hit 2021, just about all of those that predict these things predict that we're going to have a massive gap in the availability of copper in the world. And that's because the available copper resources fall off, the mines are producing less and less, and the demand is going to increase both. And Pebble fits right into that gap and will be pretty necessary source, we think, to help solve that, that dilemma. Needing to develop copper raises the question about, though, where you want to develop it. And, you know, you can develop it in third world countries where there's not environmental protection and where disasters happen like some of the ones that we've seen here in the recent past, or you can develop it in America where you have the most rigorous environmental regimen that there is and one that will protect the environment and allow us to develop copper at the same time. And that's particularly true in Alaska, where we have the highest standards for resource development, and we think this is the place that we ought to do a copper mine. So facts about Pebble. As I said, Pebble's a copper mine. It's not just a copper mine. It's also a gold mine and a silver mine and a molybdenum mine, but there's one that you may not have heard of, and that's uranium. And uranium is really critical. It's a critical mineral. It's necessary for the propeller blades in jet engines of fighter jets. And most of the uranium that's used today is imported from other countries, and there's a declining amount that's available in this country. Pebble has a huge source of uranium and can satisfy that need as we go forward. Pebble deposit is on land that's owned by the state. And interestingly, this land isn't just accidentally owned by the state. This is land that the state went after in a land exchange. It exchanged some fairly valuable timberland in order to get this particular land that had real possibility of mineral development. So the state sought this land to develop the minerals on it. And if it doesn't get the benefit of that development, it gave away valuable timberland for nothing. So it's important that we remember the history of the site, why the state acquired the land, and that it was mineral development. This is what the Pebble Project looks like. Most of you might be surprised because the pictures you usually see of the Pebble deposit are put out there by our opponents, and they show teeming rivers, and there just aren't teeming rivers where this mine site is, and this is the project location. When I was hired, the project was at a crossroads, and one of the things that John was beginning to do and that we all felt was important to do was take a step back from where the project was and to really assess what the concerns were of those that opposed the project and to redesign the project in a way that would be directly responsive to those concerns. We spent a lot of time doing that. Frankly, I don't think we get as much credit for that as we should get. But the response to that's pretty dramatic. So we went to a much smaller footprint, a much smaller mine. We went to only a 20-year project instead of a longer project. When we made the project smaller, we were able to take the footprint and make it compact so that we got entirely out of the Upper Tularic Keejack watershed. We made a decision not to bring cyanide into the region. That means that about 12% of the gold we won't be able to recover. And we're walking away from that in order to respond to this concern about cyanide being in the region. We designed a project that's not going to have any waste rock piles, which is a concern with respect to the footprint of a mine. And then we did a significant amount of work on environmental safeguards, particularly with water treatment and with tailings facilities. And we'll talk about those as we went through. The project we've taken into permitting is not the project that was being talked about over the last dozen years with respect to Pebble Mine. So this is a picture of the footprint that was one of the three projects that was analyzed by EPA when they decided to try to kill this project before we even filed a permit. EPA looked at three different sizes, and this is the largest one that they looked at. And just for some perspective on how we have redesigned the Pebble project that we've taken into permitting, this is the project we've taken into permitting. So it's about one-fifth the size of the larger project. It's about a little less than half the size of the project that we were actually considering taking into permit at the time, but a substantial reduction in size in terms of the project. So Pebble is a real asset for the state of Alaska. It's going to create thousands of jobs and hundreds of millions in tax revenue. And we think it can be developed safely. But the question is, how do you answer that question? How do you make sure that a project like Pebble that's going to go into a place like Bristol Bay is in fact going to be safe and isn't going to damage the fishery? And the answer again is the EIS process. And right now we're at a draft EIS. We've said for a long time that the Pebble deposit could be developed responsibly. when John was first offered the job of CEO of the company, the first comment he made was that he would not take this project into permitting unless he became convinced that it wouldn't damage the fishery in Bristol Bay. And we've invested a lot of time and money and effort in that. And finally, we've got an independent federal agency that has agreed with us that this project won't damage that fishery. The process is the NEPA process. We have to get roughly 60 separate categories of permits before we can build this mine. Those are federal and local and state. And so the process is a pretty substantial one. It's rigorous, it's demanding, transparent, accountable, but it's the right process. One of our major opponents here is the Natural Resources Defense Council, NRDC. And NRDC says about NEPA that it's really, you know, the democratic process to make these decisions. One of the other things they often say is that the EIS that you do under NEPA is the Magna Carta of environmental protection. And that's where we are today. We've just gotten the first draft of that EIS. Produced by the Army Corps of Engineers, it's expert. Most importantly, it's independent. So nobody was allowed to work on this project that had worked on Pebble before, on either side, excuse me, John, on either side, or had expressed a public opinion about the project. So independent scientists were brought to this effort. But they didn't work alone. These are all the agencies that were also involved. So it includes Fish and Wildlife Service, EPA, state agencies. The Lake and Penn Borough have been involved in creating this draft. And 35 separate tribal governments have been engaged in government-to-government.
I think we have a question, if you're okay with taking questions as we go. Senator Keel.
Thank you so much. Question about the involvement of the state agencies. Can you describe the level of their involvement analysis up to this point? Have they been fully involved to this point, or this is where they get involved? Help me understand where Fish and Game and DEC are on this process.
A little bit of both. They've been involved in meetings with the agency and helping to create this draft up until now. But they will have an even greater involvement as we go forward, and particularly the public comment period. They'll have an opportunity to submit public comments, and their public comments will be seen as carrying great weight in this process. And then as we move from draft to final, they'll be involved in that process also.
Okay. Thank you.
And then, Mr. Follow up. On this slide, since we've got you stopped, I did not have the time to sort of do my research. I see your list of tribal governments. Are these tribes all supportive, or have they all taken positions? Have any of them? Where does that stand?
It's a mishmash. We've got tribes on here that are supportive and tribes that are not supportive. And to be frank, probably most of these are not supportive of the project. The EPA sent out a notice to all of the tribal governments in a broad description of the region and invited them all to participate in the government-to-government negotiations with respect to the EIS, and these are the ones that chose to do so.
Thank you.
Continue, please.
So where we are in the EIS schedule, the application was filed in December of 2017. Right now, the draft has just been issued, and we've just started the public review process. So the public comment period and public hearings will last through May 30th. The projection for the draft of the final EIS will be early 2020, with the record of decision sometime in mid-2020. Been a lot of conversation about whether this process is being rushed. We're moving through it in about 2.5 to 3 years. And so we've taken a look at other development projects in Alaska and how long they've taken, and this is a fairly extensive list of some of those. I think the one that's most comparable on here, in my opinion, is Point Thompson. That was a new project going into a new area in the state, had a lot of issues associated with it, and yet that was able to move through the entire permitting process in 2.5 years. We think that's the analog to the Pebble project and is kind of proof that we're on the right timeline as we go through this. One of the other issues that's been raised is whether the public comment period has been long enough. The statute requires 45 days. The Corps has announced that it has a 90-day public comment period for our project, twice what the statute requires. And there's been some concern that that's not enough, and that that somehow is shorter than what has usually been the case on projects in Alaska. And again, if you look at the public comment periods on our list here, you'll find that we're kind of right in the sweet spot. In fact, maybe on the high end of what is usually used for public comment periods. So the real question is, what's the DIS say? There are two or three issues that are most important. The first one's water. You know, when you're building a mine, it's all about how you make sure that water quality and water quantity aren't diminished. And so we've spent an enormous amount of time and effort on those issues, because everything, people and fish and wildlife, really all depend on water. One of the biggest things we did as we redesigned the project was to get out of the Upper Tularuk and out of the Keejack. And you'll see here with this map where the Upper Tularuk Creek is and how our facilities have all been moved so that we do not impact the Upper Tularuk directly. And again, cyanide isn't coming into the region, so there'll be no secondary gold recovery. And then probably the most important point here, anybody that knows something about mining understands this, but others, it's a little hard to get your mind around. Every single drop of water that touches this project, whether it falls from the sky or it comes in the stream or it's used in the process, is captured, it is treated to Clean Water Act standards, and then it's released. The critical factor here is the release, though. You don't just release it. You have a very sophisticated computerized program that tells you when and where to release the water so that you, in fact, optimize the conditions for salmon in the region. So there may be some tributaries up here that don't have water year-round. We'll be able to release water into those so that they do have water year-round as we go forward. This is what the water treatment operation looks like, where we capture water, where we treat water, where we release water. And the couple of things on this that are, I think, most significant. If you look to the left side, that's the bulk tailings facility. The critical point there is you'll notice that there's just a little bit of water in the corner of that tailings facility. That's not accidental. That's by design. We'll talk about that a little bit more, but I want to point this picture out to you to recall when we get to our discussion of the tailings facility. And then a little further back is a water containment pond that's there so that we can capture all the water and keep it until we're able to treat it and release it, even in years of pretty high precipitation. We've got the capacity to do that. So the EIS looks at the water resource issue and looks at it pretty carefully. And it concludes that a sophisticated management plan will discharge water into all three nearby streams to benefit the fish habitat. Not to hurt it, to benefit it. There will be no downstream impacts once we close this pit, when we're finished with 20 years, from this project in the region. Tailings. Been a lot of talk about tailings facilities, some concern with respect to what's happened in other countries. And so we've really looked at our tailings facilities hard and have combined the natural resources and features and engineered features to design according to very conservative criteria. So designed it for maximum safety, and it's a pretty interesting design we have here. This is the bulk facility, and the interesting part of this design is that we chose to build one that allows the water to flow through and get captured in a containment pond on the other side of the dam. And the reason that's so important is that the failures that have occurred recently and back through Mount Polly and others have all been associated with facilities that were not designed for the amount of water that they ended up capturing and containing. And so if you take water management out of your tailings facility, you really don't have much of a risk associated with that facility. And so there's very little water, just enough actually to get the tailings into the facility. They need water to be transported there. and then it will drain through. You'll also notice a significant slope on the embankment here, and then there are buttresses also. So this is designed to a very high level of safety to make sure that the tailings facility is adequate. Most importantly is that before we can start construction of either of these tailings facilities, we've got to be certified by the Alaska Dam Safety Program. That's a big deal. It's probably the most rigorous program in the country, and it is one that's day-to-day management is certainly the most rigorous in the country. We also separated out the peritic tailings from the bulk tailings. Yes, sir.
Excuse me. I think we have a question here. Senator
Thank
Keel.
You. Appreciate it, Mr. Chair. Mr. Collier, we just passed a supplemental appropriation bill for some earthquake damage. To what seismic standard have you designed your impoundment here? How big a shaker is it supposed to withstand?
Huge. But let's talk a little bit about seismic since you raised it. Alaska thinks of itself as an earthquake zone. But if you start looking carefully at where the earthquakes actually occur, a dot on the map every time there's been one recorded history, you find that out there in Bristol Bay there aren't any. And in fact, this big quake we had in Anchorage, that broke all of my nice bottles of wine off the shelf, wasn't felt at all at the mine site. It wasn't recorded. At the mine site, and that's because the fault lines just aren't there. Now, that doesn't mean we haven't designed to a very significant quake at the site, even though the fault lines aren't there. We have, and in addition, something that's important to understand about these tailings facilities is they're essentially pilings of sand, and so in Chile, when it had several years of really disastrous earthquakes that did enormous damage in urban areas, none of the tailings facilities were impacted or failed. We have designed to a very conservative, much higher than necessary standard to deal with earthquakes, and in fact, the earthquake risk is not that significant at the site.
Just a follow-up. Is there a page in the EIS where I can find the number? Do you know the
we'll
number?
We'll get that to you. Yes.
Thank you.
Thank you. Okay, proceed.
Peritic tailings facility is fully lined, and the reason it is that peritic tailings that present the risk of potentially generating acid. And so two things about this facility. The first one is that it does need water on top of it. And so by separating out these tailings, which are about 12% of the total tailings, we have a smaller facility, one that we can fully line. And you don't want to line the bulk facility because, as I told you before, we want water to drain through that one. But this one we don't. And so this is fully lined. It'll be covered by water, and it's smaller than the facility. But the pretty significant development that we've done here is that the plan, the reclamation plan at the end of 20 years, is that we're going to put these tailings back in the pit. So they'll be stored below the water table in the pit. There'll be water on top of them constantly. It'll be a lake. In fact, I think I've got a picture of what that will look like, and that's what the pit will look like with the tailings in the bottom of it afterwards. The draft EIS says a couple things about tailings. I think the most important one is that catastrophic failure is extremely unlikely. And then second, they did a number of evaluations of scenarios where there would be failures of the tailings facility, and they conclude that there are no population-level impacts for fish from the tailings releases that might occur with those scenarios. Salmon. We've always said that we won't build this mine if we're going to put the salmon in the region at risk. And so we've done more than a decade of intensive studies. We spent $150 million just on studying the environment, wetlands, groundwater, surface water, migration patterns, fish habitat. Our biologists, fish biologists, joke that they know the name of every salmon that comes up into the region. The starting point for this analysis is that in the mine area, escapement is very low. So there aren't very many fish up. The picture I showed you. So the epitaloric drainage had about 0.4% of all the salmon in Bristol Bay that would come up there. And when we took that out of the picture, we then were left with just the South Fork of the Kaktuli and the North Fork of the Kaktuli. And that is 0.08% of all the salmon in Bristol Bay that would be at risk in the area where the mine is.
Senator Cockey?
I just wanted to get that quantification narrowed down a little bit. Is this from all of Bristol Bay or just those that flow up the river?
It's the escapement into the river from Bristol Bay.
Continue.
So mining and fish do coexist. Our plan applies the best science and Alaska's highest standards. And in Alaska, there's responsible development that coexists with fish and wildlife. And we all know the projects. There's Fort Knox and Greens Creek and Kensington and Pogo and Red Dog. And we've got a long history of being able to do that in Alaska. But the most important issue, so we spent 12 years at least talking about whether if you put a mine in Bristol Bay, you risk the fishery. And there's been a lot said about it and a lot of words back and forth. But we've now finally got an independent scientific analysis that tells us a couple of pretty important things. The first is the project will not reduce the returning adult salmon in the river systems. Second, the impacts to fish and wildlife would not be expected to impact harvest levels because there will be no decrease in the resource and the abundance. No long-term change to the health effect of Bristol Bay and Cook Inlet fisheries. And there are other salmon fisheries in Alaska that coexist with the extraction industries. So the draft EIS takes a look at the issue of will the mine damage the fishery? It concludes no, after 12 years of debate. John is going to talk a little bit about the economic impacts of the project and other impacts of the project.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. For the record, my name is John Shively. A little background on how I got into this project. I had this really nice job with the cruise industry with lots of fringe benefits and got approached by Northern Dynasty and Anglo-American about becoming the CEO. And a lot of people really thought that I was nuts to take on a project like this, knowing that it was very controversial and not only would the project be viciously attacked, but I would receive my own fair share of personal attacks. And I did it really for one reason, and that is I had, in my past history, as some of you know, worked for NANA when we got Red Dog. I worked on getting the selection rights. I worked on negotiating with Cominco to put together the agreement that got the mine started and had some other participation. And I saw what that project did for that region. I mean, it allowed them to set up a rural government. It allowed them to get money into that government to help improve the education system. It gave jobs to people. The native hire up there has always been above 50%. It's changed people's lives. It changed the region for the better. And I knew, despite the controversy, that there was a very good chance we could do the same thing with Pebble. However, when I was recruited by Anglo-American and Northern Dynasty, I told both of them at the time that if they were looking for a cheerleader, it was not me, because I didn't know enough about the project. I knew it was in a sensitive area, and they hired me anyway. But I now am a cheerleader. I've spent over a decade on the project. Tom's talked about the science, about what we can do, and I'm convinced this is a project that can be built safely and will bring major benefits to the local area and to the state as a whole. Benefits that will support not only the economy out there, but the culture, because as we know, rural communities are losing people. They're losing them at a very fast rate. This will allow people to stay there. It's also the kind of work situation that will allow people to both have a job and to participate in the subsistence economy, which is so important both to their economic well-being and their cultural well-being. It's the statewide benefits to this project. We will spend over $400 million a year in operations. So that's money that goes to wages, it goes to equipment companies, it goes to airlines, it goes to food service companies. So it will have an impact. It will have a tax impact. We believe that for the Lake and Peninsula Borough, what we will give them is about three times their current budget. This is a local government that is facing very serious difficulties, particularly with their education system. Last year, they reduced their school year by 20 days because of the economic problems they're facing. It will have an impact locally. It will have an impact on the state. Next slide.
I'm sorry, John.
It'll have an impact on the state. We will pay three kinds of payments to the state. We will pay mining license tax, we will pay corporate income tax, and we will pay state royalties, some of which go into the permit fund because we are on state land. The jobs, probably at the lower end because we have a smaller project of those figures here, but 750 to 850 jobs. We believe that a number of those jobs, like with Red Dog, will be held by local people who we will train to take those jobs. The average mining wage is over $100,000 a year. And as I said earlier, those are jobs that are primarily rotational jobs, so people will be able to both make money to feed their families and have opportunities for subsistence activities. The draft EIS says several things. The project benefits will be most apparent in the small rural communities closest, which of course is one of our goals. And you know, in terms of if you look at how people feel about the project out there, our strongest support is from people that are closest to the mine because I've already seen some of the economic benefits we've provided during exploration. The DEIS says it'll have minimal impact on access to subsistence resources. Of course, there'll be some things built. But importantly, as Tom pointed out earlier, there's going to be no change in the abundance of the resource. So the ability to harvest is not going to be changed. Go ahead. So basically, certainly jobs are important. Tax revenues are important. I've often said in terms of jobs that the most effective social program that anybody can find is giving somebody a job. I've seen it change people's lives. I've seen it, people tend to have more hope. They tend to also, I think, behave better. Because they have a reason to behave better, and some of the social dislocation we see in rural Alaska, I've seen change because of these kinds of things. And then there are even little things that I think people often miss about these projects. When we were sort of at the height of our exploration program and we had more money to help out in the state than we do now, we did a number of things. We supported the Alaska Native Science and Engineering Program at $75,000 a year. We supported geology and mining programs in both Fairbanks and Anchorage. We supported a whole variety of social programs, both in the region and out of the region. And when you get a project like this and you get companies that are dedicated to the state, then you see not only the jobs, not only the tax revenues, and the economic impact, but you see, I think, a very important underlying social impact.
So we think we've got a clear path forward now with the draft EIS, and we're pretty excited about where we are and where we're headed. The EIS says clearly that Alaska's resource projects already coexist with fishing, and that Pebble its approach will be to use industry best practices, that the project benefits include increased revenue, employment, and education. There'll be no downstream impacts from the pit in post-closure, and there will be no long-term change in the health of Bristol Bay and Cook Inlet fisheries. And, you know, Alaska knows how to develop these projects, and we're eager for our project to be the next one that's developed, and we're looking forward to working together as we move to doing that. And we really believe that that we've now got the right mind and we've got the right time and we're going to move forward with it.
Great. Thank you very much for your presentation this afternoon. Very informative. Let's see if there's any questions, committee members. Senator Reinbold.
Just two questions. The first one probably be for you, and the second would be for Mr. Shively. Is there any competing mines or any competing opportunities for mines in that region that you're aware of, either on native lands or other state lands or anything? Is there anything that you're aware of?
Senator Reinbold, through the chair, James Fugue. Nothing in the immediate area that we're aware of. There are other exploration projects out there, but to the best of my knowledge, none of them actually have a defined resource associated with them. I stand subject to correction on that. But.
Through the chair, second question.
Proceed.
Mr. Shively, will you drink the tailings again like you did?
I will drink the tailings anytime anybody wants. Not the paritic tailings. See, now, the tailings I drank were a combination and are largely bulk tailings. They're not toxic. They don't taste very good, but sure.
Other questions? Seeing Senator Keel.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I guess the first question was just one to clear up from earlier, the very beginning. You were talking about the minerals in the project. Did you say radium or rhenium?
Rhenium.
Rhenium. Thank you. I was sure I heard you wrong. I'm glad I did. That helps a lot. And then I guess questions about the new plan that I should say the plan in the EIS that seems to do with only. Was it only temporary surface storage of waste rock as opposed to permanent storage? What's the waste rock?
No waste rock storage. And when we made the mine smaller, we were able to come at the deposit in a way that we are attacking it where it has its lowest strip ratio. So there will be very little and almost no waste rock. You have to rip off before you get to the ore. And the waste rock that we do find, we're just going to put into the tailings facility so that we won't have separate waste rock piles. And that's a pretty significant development that has made this project smaller and much more environmentally sensitive.
I mean, so the capacity then of the tailings facility will give you, especially if it has to hold the waste rock, will give you the ability to mine how much of the probable ore body?
At what percentage?
I'd say
of
the order of 10%.
That's right. Yeah. About 10%.
10%. So, if I may, Mr. Chairman, then the likelihood is for future expansions or new facilities in the future. How would that be handled? I mean, presumably with 10% of an ore body and an operating mine and workers trained and infrastructure, that the goal then at 10% will be to find a way to do more of the ore body.
Yeah, it wouldn't surprise me a bit if there's not an expansion plan that comes along after this. But right now, we don't have any such plans, and so it's hard to answer your question about where it's going to go. We have a ton of alternatives. This thing's been studied for 12 years at least, and there have been countless options as to how to come at it and how to develop it. But my sense is that we're going to go ahead with this 20-year plan. We're going to get it permitted. And at some point in the future, somebody else is going to make a decision about whether or not it should be expanded. The key to that, though, is that expansion is going to require another permitting process. And I try to explain it this way. So we've designed a mine that's only this size. And we think that it's the right mine to go forward with at this time, and that's what we're going to do. If sometime in the future somebody wants to add an expansion on, they have the issue then, not just this size. They've got to deal with this size, okay? And they've got to show that the mine, as expanded, will work in that region without causing significant environmental challenges. And I think there'll be some questions they'll have to address at that time.
Just to follow up, just for my ignorance, is that a new EIS at that? If that happens, and I know we're talking in the subjunctive here, but if that happens, is that a new EIS? Is that a state permitting process? What?
It depends on what the proposed expansion is. If it's a sliver around an edge that's necessary for some crazy reason, it might not require a new EIS. But any kind of significant expansion of this project would require the entire EIS process to be done again.
Okay, and then one last one, Mr. Chairman. Thank you. Pull back a little bit and ask you to do sort of put your big think hat on. A couple of great hard rock mines in my district, and they work really hard to recruit and train locally. And what we have seen as the mining industry has done well is that they're camp mines, and they have to compete for workers. And even with the same people, their percentage of Alaskans on staff has dropped precipitously. They're working on it, but we see the dislocation. So this is a community of 31,000 in a region of 77. Thoughts about, I mean, Mr. Shively used the word dislocation as something to be avoided, and I think admirably. The unintended consequence and the potential there for a greater dislocation. Have you thought that through, and what opportunities do you see?
Well, we think we have. We put an awful lot of time and effort into planning our workforce development strategy for the project. And what we want to do is to recruit people that live in the region now, that want to stay in the region and want to work there. We've already gone out soliciting those that might be interested in the necessary training to get back to us so that we can begin that. Some of the longer-term training can start now, some of the basic educational training that's necessary. But you don't want to train workers too much in advance of them actually having a job, because you create problems for yourself, obviously, if you do. We are just beginning to crank up that effort. We've got John, who has been quite experienced with what happened at NANA and how best to do that. And we have a number of other consultants that helped with that process. But one of our highest priorities is how to deal with this issue. We want a workforce that is a local workforce, predominantly, and a workforce that wants to stay in the region.
Mr. Chairman, John Shively, I also might add, I think one of the other differences is I believe both the mines in your district are underground mines, and underground mining is a much more difficult discipline to recruit people to. It takes a certain kind of person to basically end up living in the dark if you work the day shift 24 hours a day. And I think that has been a factor here in trying to keep people in Juneau. And actually the other problem you have is it's a pretty short flight to Seattle from here, whereas where we're dealing with is longer. And I think what we've seen at Red Dog is that some people do move out of the region. We've seen that at Red Dog, but also we've seen people moving back in. And it's not only that, it's the other thing is not just the mining jobs. If you've got a local government that's all of a sudden expanded their operations and air taxi services are expanding theirs and other things, you have other jobs that are keeping people locally that just don't exist now.
Thank you. Okay, seeing Senator Kawasaki.
Just a couple questions back to the EIS process. You mentioned that this is a much smaller footprint than was originally anticipated, and no cyanide, no waste rock piles. Let me try and figure out if the EIS proposed now has this in it. And if there's any expansion, or if you decide later on that you'd like to do enhanced recovery, would you have to reapply to, say, use cyanide or create waste rock piles?
Probably each of the changes would require different permits of different types. Some would require a whole host of permits, and some would require fewer permits to be issued.
Through the chair. But you won't have to redo the EIS process?
Depends on what the change is. If the change is double the size, we probably have to redo the entire process.
Okay. And then through the chair, who makes that decision?
The regulatory agencies do. We don't.
Okay. Question about the economics of it. We know that when the larger the proposal, generally the cheaper and less expensive per tonnage. Can you tell me how the smaller footprint has impacted the economy, the economic feasibility of this particular proposal?
Well, it's not as good as a big one.
Sure.
And what we wrestled with when we locked ourselves up in a room to do the redesign was to find that sweet spot where we had just enough economic profit in the project to be confident we could develop the mine and yet made the footprint as small as we possibly could to hit that footprint. And that's what we think we've done.
So, through the chair, so then is there an economic feasibility study on this proposal?
We have a lot of internal economics, but mm-hmm. we are not in a position because of a lot of regulatory requirements dealing with mining and what you can release and when you can release it and how you can release it to release those at this point.
Okay. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
You bet. Seeing no further questions, I want to take this opportunity to thank you for coming to Juneau and making the trip here to give us kind of an update on the project and as you kick off this draft EIS. Thank you again for the presentation this afternoon, and appreciate you being here. I would next note that the next Resources Committee meeting will be held at 3:30 p.m. on Wednesday, March 27th, when we'll have two items on the agenda, SB 51, National Resources Water Nomination and Designation, and SB 42, Quitclaim Land to the United States. With that, this meeting is adjourned at 4:33 p.m.